Kia ora. Welcome to Microwave Feminism.
But this time, it's season two.
In season two, Tash and I bring our most authentic selves to explore, in conversation with others, what feminism means to us and where we see ourselves within questions of feminism.
We are here for authentic, vulnerable, and playful conversations with you.
And of course, talking about what it's like to be a badass feminist.
No mai, haere mai.
Welcome, and we hope you enjoy.
Hello, hello, movers, groovers, booty shakers and earthquakers. How are you? It's been a while since we filled your ears with some microwave feminism. But don't worry, the wait was worth it. And we're back with a conversation between Jazz and Ganesh, an intergenerational conversation that will nourish your soul. I've been doing some research around what are called blue zones, places in the planet where people live to wild old ages. And one of the key themes is that all of these spaces are naturally intergenerational communities, people of different ages, stages, sharing wisdom and curiosity. And I realized how important that intergenerational aspect is to our foundational well-being, to our movements, to sustainable change. And this is exactly what this conversation provides. Jazz and Ganesh talk about privilege and prejudice and how the pendulum can swing between those two things. You get an awesome insight into how feminism runs through Ganesh's everyday life, unpacking some of those social interactions that happen on the daily. They talk about equity versus equality and so much more. Nourish your soul, dive into it. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Hi. Tanakwe.
Tanakwe. How are you?
I'm well.
Yeah?
Yeah, really good, actually.
Good. I'm very excited to have you here in the microwave.
I feel honoured to be asked to be here, so that's very exciting for me too.
He's been pushing himself on me for months.
Okay,
like, I'm honoured to have been asked, offered this opportunity, of the sweat of my own back.
Has my subtle, you know, kind of suggestiveness, you know, made it seem like it's your idea?
It's come through. It's, yeah, isn't that called manipulation?
No!
That's called manipulation.
No, my baby. Yeah.
So let's start at the beginning.
Right.
Who are you?
So my name is Ganesh Cherian, and my mother's from Dannevirke, around that area, rural New Zealand, and she went on an overseas trip as a, you know, 20-something, and travelled to Australia, and then into Southeast Asia, and then ended up in India. It was the early 70s, so a time when this kind of hippie revolution of, you know, enlightenment and discovery, I suppose, took her to India, which was kind of the, had become the real enlightenment space, to a holy city in India, Varanasi. And met my father, who was there kind of doing a bit of a philosophy degree, kind of a perpetual student by this point. And, you know, of course, you know, young people sitting around pontificating about their lives, you know, one thing led to another and I was conceived. And then my parents had to think about whether they could make this into a long-term thing. So I was born in India, and then my mother's brother was getting married, and so my grandparents paid for her and my dad, I suppose, who were, at this time, you know, late 20s, but probably pretty poor, to come back to New Zealand. And so I was 6 months old and lived here my whole life, and in Wellington pretty much that whole time, except for a few stints in other places. I've always come back. And now my mother lives back in Dannevirke, and my sister, who lives in Tauranga, And I'm the last one left, but I've managed to go overseas, find an American, help her escape the oppressive regime and resettle in New Zealand as a political refugee, and have five children. So in many ways I'm definitely a Wellingtonian. I feel very, you know, I feel very European, but also a bit of flavour there being Indian. But I'm also a husband and a father, and I own a business making headstones, and I like people, and so I'm active in the community. I love Wellington, so I do lots of those kinds of things. In terms of who I am as a person, I think I'm, well, I like to think that I'm, you know, a kind and generous soul who looks out for others, and I've come from some challenging circumstances, so I feel very nurturing of others who've found themselves in difficult spaces. So I feel like I'm a bit of a cheerleader in many ways. That's my personality. I like to, I guess, see what people are capable of, and I like to explore. So I've tried different things, and trying different things all the time to see what kind of fits and what I enjoy and what else there is to explore. And even in a little city like Wellington, there seems to be a lot to explore. You know, so I've done lots of things over the years, become a runner, joined Rotary, been, you know, active in some faith communities, been, you know, done some volunteering, tried on some leadership. Yeah, just I like to try new things, I like karaoke and singing, as well as dancing. I love to dance, movement, sport. I play squash. I for a short time when I was in the United States, I was a rugby coach, international rugby coach, and I love dress ups. Not kind of in the cosplay kind of a thing. That would be kind of cool. Maybe you haven't got that quite to that point yet, but I like to, you know, take on, you know, kind of, you know, different roles and see how that, you know, works. I've changed my hairstyle quite a bit to reflect some of that. And I you know, I feel kind of innovative and exploratory as I kind of navigate the world and see what A is on offer, but also B, what maybe I can do that might be useful and building and fulfilling. So, yeah, those are kind of the things that are me, I think.
I think we're done here, folks. Right, that's it. Podcast over.
All right. Whew. Gosh, that was a long time.
I think the way you answer that question says something really interesting. And so Ganesh is the oldest guest we've ever had. I'm not saying you're old. Right. I'm saying you're the oldest guest that we've ever had. And often when we ask people this question, they struggle, you know. Maybe their answer takes about 30 seconds. But we've just been given a really beautiful blurb around your life. And maybe that comes from, maybe that's just who you are. But maybe it comes from the wisdom of age. We won't say how many.
Well, gosh, you can say I'm turning 50 this year, so I'm feeling very old. But also, like, I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. So I'm still learning, and I like the idea of learning, really. And so I feel like I'm a bit of a people collector, because I recognise that there's not enough time in anybody's life to do everything. So I try and connect with lots of different people and vicariously participate in their lives or understand some of the things that they might have come to know, because I'm willing to ask questions and find out. And sometimes they tell me things and I'm like, wow, I've never thought of that before. And other times they go, gosh, that's really tough, and I, you know, I'm sorry that's happening to you, you know, and I hope I can make it easier.
That might lead us nicely on to the next question. What's one thing at the moment that you're really passionate about?
Oh, so I'm doing a comedy course at the moment. So
did I set that up for him to say that? I don't know.
I you know, gosh, part of connecting with people is also seeing that there's little oddities about all of us and the ways that we do things. And so I've been thinking about it for a while, and it's just come up. And so I'm doing a comedy class, and I'm, you know, learning how to structure my observations in the way that's hopefully humorous, and then to perform that in front of others.
And what about that is passion for you?
I think it's that I'm, you know, I did psychology. I'm a real people person, but also a bit of a people watcher. So watching others, watching myself, and then trying to understand what's going on in people's heads and my own head, and also kind of what the connection is between what you think and how you act, and if that's predictable, right? Mm. If you can take somebody's or maybe deconstruct somebody's understanding or person and see if you can then, you know, make deep connections or even understand what might happen next. Mm. I find that quite good. I must admit that my strike rate's not very good. I don't necessarily can tell exactly what's going to happen next, but I can often have a conversation and really listen and really hear, maybe from what people say or maybe what they don't say, and be able to come to a reasonable understanding of them, and in that moment people can feel really heard and validated.
Mm.
And I find I'm really passionate about that. So the comedy's kind of it's a extension of that.
Yeah.
And I do that in lots of areas, and I have done that in lots of areas, but it's quite a unique way of doing it, and it's kind of helping me to understand better, I suppose.
Very cool. I love that. Third intro question. I know there are many, but what's one reason why you were excited to come into the microwave today?
Oh, because I really like you. Well, and I like your perspective, and I've listened to your podcast, and so it's really interesting to hear, you know, gosh, what's happening in your schema. I feel like if I understand too, I'm going to be a better person for that. Plus two, as you know, I've got five boys.
Mm.
And I always wanted to have a daughter. And because I'm raising boys, I guess I feel some responsibility to be a good role model, but also that my boys will navigate the world in really positive, uplifting and useful ways. And I suppose that's going to play into their relationships, particularly with the women in their lives.
Yeah.
So there's some responsibility there. And so if I understand what the world looks like for women, then I can maybe help that be a better space, A, from my interactions, but hopefully by having those kind of discussions with my boys, and hopefully, well, then they probably have those discussions with me too, right? And it's, I guess, a bridging of the generations too.
Mm.
I'm really invested in the future because I have children, and so I'm interested that future is going to be better for everybody involved.
Mm. I love that. That's awesome. Okay, now that we've heard a bit more about you, let's sink our teeth into the topic, i.e. Ganesh's mind on feminism.
Mm.
What does feminism mean to you?
I think just simply, feminism is the empowerment of women. That's kind of what I've understood it to mean. I guess the thing that I find really tricky for me personally is understanding kind of my role in that. You know, can men be feminists, or is my involvement limited to being an ally?
Mm.
And then what does that look like? What can I do to make things better and more inclusive and more fair and more useful? And I guess I don't necessarily know the answer to those questions, but I'm willing to ask some questions and willing to listen to other people in that process and what they think. I guess too, I have some observations because I am that kind of people watching, and I'm interested in history. I'm really a big history buff, particularly 19th century history. And so, gosh, I love period dramas. I read a lot of 19th century literature. And I guess that kind of dawning of a difference in relationship, Western society maybe more so than Eastern society, but that kind of idea of relationships being about a emotional benefit to the parties involved rather than just a matrimonial one. And I think we're fortunate in New Zealand. We have a very large middle class and very few at the very top or very bottom. In other Western countries. There's been a lot of strata in terms of class. Mm. And so there's some things that have been a part of history which have changed and were changing a lot during the 19th century, which was the idea that you married for mutual benefit. Well, sorry, everybody's always married for mutual benefit, but they've often been, you know, if you were a woman, you tend to partner for stability.
Yeah.
And if you're a man, you'd partner for progeny and continuation. So there was often lots of contracts around that, and they were often very tangible. So, you know, women tend to marry or were encouraged to marry up, and men were encouraged to, you know, marry somebody very stable. So, but this played out in slightly different ways. So if you were in the upper echelon, you kind of married to sustain your current wealth. And if you were in the very poor, you were often just trying to be sustained at all. But the middle class meant that people started to form relationships because they had means backing them, whether it was family or maybe even their own ability to take care of their own finances, meant that people started to choose to marry for emotional benefit. And that caused all sorts of really interesting dynamics, which authors like Jane Austen played on. And, you know, the idea of romance became a much bigger portion of why you would partner. Up until that point, lots of marriages were transactional, and then you might have another relationship which was emotional. But then by the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century, there was the idea that your partner would be everything to you, you know, your financial support, your emotional support, your intimate support. It's changed relationships dramatically. It's put a lot of expectation on relationships too. Mm. So that has, you know, like all ages, those who can play that role well end up being privileged in it, and those that can't find themselves prejudiced by that. If you were in a loveless marriage and you could just handle it, then you kind of, you know, got a lot of privilege in your community. And if you couldn't, then you were the playboy or the, you know, the slut or whatever. So there was a lot of, you know, prejudice that went on there. And that's one of my other kind of interests, I guess, is how those kind of privileges and prejudices play out in people's lives.
Mm.
And, you know, what those negotiations look like. And so, of course, you know, in our current age, like my parents, like I began with, kind of were at that beginning of the idea that there was going to be a relationship based on mutual pleasure even, right? Mm. That sex could be something that you did for fun because birth control made it possible where there weren't as many unintended children. And so that flipped the script for a lot of, you know, the previous generation. My mother was one of seven, right? And then she only had two children. So the idea that birth control could change the dynamics of a family was a dramatic change in the 70s. And then, of course, now people are making other choices around their relationships and whether this other person's going to be everything or whether they're going to occupy a particular part in their life. So they might have an open relationship or they might have relationships that don't actually end up having children. I think a lot of the kind of the, well, certainly in the 1970s, it was, or in the 80s perhaps, there was a lot of prejudice against kind of homosexual relationships because they weren't going to result in children.
Mm.
And so that was kind of going to be the downfall of mankind. Mm. Obviously, we've got past that and realised that's not going to happen. But, you know, that was a fear that people had, and that was the idea that, gosh, if people chose and could just have sex without there being any progeny, that this would, you know, mean the selfish society which would, you know, implode on each other. Obviously, A, that didn't happen. But there's still lingering ideas around that. But now if you're in a relationship or you're starting a relationship, you might be doing it with a lot more intentionality, but also a lot more complexity because it might involve other people. There might be more than two people in a relationship. So that could be freeing for some people and also really challenging for other people. So it's really interesting to see how those things change. But I guess the same implication happens is that those who navigate that or comfortable in that space seem to be privileged in it, and those people who find themselves really tough find it really tough, right? And going back 30 or 40 years, you know, those were the questions that women were having about not just loveless marriages, but maybe even violent relationships, right? If I left, could I be sustained? And lots of people chose the idea, well, I'll put up with the violence because I've got somewhere to eat. We've long since provided opportunities for women to leave violent relationships, and that seems to be possible. And divorce is such that it's not, there's no, not as much stigma. Mm. So therefore people can leave even loveless marriages or relationships and not feel burdened. People don't go, wasn't hitting you, so, you know, why are you left? So there's much more an idea that, you know, you want and maybe perhaps even can have a fulfilling relationship which is long term, but that may not necessarily be with the same person for the whole of your life too. So it's interesting how things change. And also I think that's a really important feature of feminism. It's brought a lot of those things to play. And that's had a dramatic effect on the ways that we do things and what we expect from our lives. I think those are great things. I'm interested in feminism as a mechanism of societal change, and of course, what's the next things? The burning of bras back in the 70s, it was a very physical representation. Those feminists probably wouldn't even recognise the feminists today, but that's because, gosh, they were dealing with a whole lot of other things, and now 30, 40, 50 years on, the constraints are completely different. So the questions that you're asking about, what is the world going to look like for me and others around me going into the future, and also maybe even our children or non-children, maybe we won't have children, what does that look like for the future and our world? Those are all things that are very, I find, fascinating. But also I think that it's easy too, as you get older, and I'm getting in that direction, that you start to romanticise your growing up, thinking that that's the way everybody should do it. And so I have to keep reminding myself, gosh, we had some trials as a family. There was definitely some domestic violence growing up, and my parents split. That was quite a big deal. But gosh, they were options, right? Had it been 20 years earlier, maybe there wouldn't have been those options. And now, some 30 years later, what the options that people have that you know, weren't even available then, and what are the options likely to be in the future? I don't know. I guess that's part of the excitement about thinking about it and exploring and figuring out what works and what doesn't. Like I said, my parents split up when I was about 11. My sister and I, so 4 years younger. So, you know, that was a big, big thing. I've gone on to be married many, many more years than my parents were. And had many more children than my and gosh, just because of the amount of children we had, we were a very kind of traditional family, in that I did most of the earning and he did most of the child rearing. But in our later parts of our lives, of course, as the kids got older, you know, he's pursued a career, and also in kind of female empowerment through midwifery. And yeah, my situation has been quite different than my parents, in ways that I, didn't expect. So what will my children's relationships look like? Will they be quite different than my experience or my parents' experience? I suspect so. So hopefully I can be supportive and empowering of all of the people that come through my door as connected to me because of their relationship, particularly with my children.
I suspect you already are.
Yes, I feel like that, and I've been privileged to be so. I don't know what that will look like going forward, but I'm hopeful it's going to be building. It's been lovely so far.
Tapping more into that, so this idea of your role, you said at the beginning these questions come up, like can men be feminists? What does that look like? Blah, blah, blah. What do you think that has looked like for you? How do you feel personally about those questions?
I feel like I've tried to be supportive and empowering of the women in my life. I guess one of the things that I find slightly tricky, it goes back to that kind of privilege prejudice kind of thing.
Mm.
Like there are things that I do notice that I do differently with the women in my life as opposed to the men, yeah. Right? So, for instance, a good example would be that if I'm out to dinner with friends and there are, you know, like if it's women present and they're with, you know, with us, tend to pay for them. But if there are guys present, I won't be so forthcoming, or might be a lot more reciprocal, right? They might be counting, okay, they've bought this round of drinks, then I'll buy this round of drinks. Yeah. In the back of my head, it's, you know, tit for tat kind of a thing, and you're making sure it's kind of fair, even though somebody's paying. But certainly when women around or sons, girlfriends are with us, right, you know, then I'll just pay, and I'll expect to pay. And I won't expect that that person will reciprocate. And part of that's an age thing, but also there's something about being a provider. I grew up in a fairly egalitarian house. My dad worked, my mother worked. I think my mother might have earned a little bit more money than my dad. So that was, but in my current situation, or certainly being the main provider in our family, has made me a lot more of a provider generally. Mm. So then I tend to pay. So that's interesting because in some ways feminism and feminist empowerment suggests that I should be trying to be an ally by helping people to take care of themselves and also be empowered themselves to have and be able to do and be able to provide for themselves and for other people. But generally, how that plays out in my interactions is that I expect to pay and I will pay. And it's part of feeling generous, but it's also just a kind of a maybe even a comparison to think, okay, well, and not that I think that any of the women need me to do that, but it just kind of feels like a role, you know?
Well, I guess I have a really interesting relationship with this particular concept. And I think you've just touched on it, but let's take age out of the question. So when it's not people who are younger, no one needs anyone else. If you're going out for dinner together and you're with a friend's whatever, it's probably pretty obvious that no one needs anyone else to pay for it, right?
Yes.
So let's take kind of that off the table. But I do think I've come to terms with the fact from a couple of my really close male friends that there might be a difference for some people in the amount of joy it fills them to be able to pay for somebody.
Yeah.
And as long as they're underlying that, there isn't, you don't have the capacity to, you're not earning enough because you're a woman, which I'm not saying there is, but as long as there isn't these kind of negative things underneath that, I think that's a beautiful thing. I think that anyone should be able to feel empowered to feel like they're, providing for a group of people or even just one person. And if one person's going to feel shame or even embarrassment if they don't get to do that thing, like if it would actually hurt me if you were like, let's split the bill or whatever, I actually wanted to pay, then I think go off, like go ahead. Yeah. And especially I think if you, obviously feminism has many different ways to look at any particular situation because feminism is a plethora of ideas, but one way I bring in is like, I'd happily save my money and let someone else pay for me. Like that money is going towards something more useful than this meal. But I think it's a really interesting, that even just that tiny little social interaction that goes on at the end of a meal is so interesting.
Yeah, and I'm in a position I can, so I do. But I do think about it and think, well, you know, what is empowerment? But there's something lovely about somebody doing something very generous for you.
Yeah.
You know, and I appreciate it when other people do that for me too. So I'm certainly not I mean, gosh, I'm the product of lots of people's generosity, so I do want to be the kind of person that is generous to others. So then there's always that kind of question of what does that look like, and how do I make sure it's always validating and empowering.
I think generosity is a great value because, I don't know about you, but generosity for me isn't a gendered value. There are many out there that are, but generosity doesn't seem like one.
Those are the kind of, those are things that I do think about occasionally. And I do think that, and I guess one of the parts of that is maybe my, the ways that I treat women and men are different.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I'm being a feminist, I should kind of treat everybody, you know, fairly equally. But then there's always that point of equity too, right? I'm going, actually, this person might need a little bit more, or this person needs. But this certainly plays out in lots of interesting ways, right? Like we had boys, five boys. So we tended to have, and we've had people kind of live with us over the years. And the vast majority of them were women for a couple of reasons. One is that it was safe, you know, for the boys. And also maybe at some level too, the, you know, improve the adult-to-child ratio, which was really helpful. But also the idea that women was maybe more likely to be in the nurturing space, and so more likely to be another set of hands rather than not. So there's a couple of, you know, stereotype or prejudices that end up being privileges, right? You know? So there's a couple of things like that that are quite interesting. So we will, and that plays out in society too, right? We tend to be a lot more aware and perhaps look for opportunities to help women who are homeless as opposed to men, right? Or we help women who are in domestic violence abuses as opposed to men. Women tend to be better at establishing community and seeking out collective help, so they tend to have better mental health. You know, they obviously suffer less from suicide. They also might, they generally are better at keeping their health, or women live longer than men. You know, so there's all of these kind of inequalities that are privileges almost, right? So on the one hand, there are some, you know, challenges about being a woman. Huge challenges, you know, educational aspirations, childbirth, of course, and the resources.
That old chestnut.
The resources that go into that from men and women, earning capacity, maybe even kind of, you know, menial type jobs too. All of those things that might be really tough for women to navigate. Health is often bigger with women than men. Except that, the flip side's also true, right? You know, you're more likely as a society, and as I talked about an example of myself, that, you know, you're going to look out for the women in your life rather than the men in your life, and you're going to more easily accept them into your homes or look out for them than you are the men. And so that, I find that really fascinating too. So there's a bit of a kind of a push me, pull me with that kind of idea of empowerment, that on the one hand, trying to change these things so that things are better for women. But on the other hand, there's some things that women tend to get that men in the same circumstances don't get. There's a lot more kind of, what's the word, acceptance of women who are single than men who are single. Seems to be a dearth of men. I've noticed that there are a lot of men who live on their own who tend to get very recluse, but women who live on their own often surround themselves with other forms of community. So it's really fascinating to see those slight differences.
Especially when you add into that, like, intersectionality, and because that's where my brain's going in a lot of this too, is that those things I think are true in general across the board, and then they become even more true when you add in men of colour, any men who are marginalised in society for any other particular reason, lower class, whatever it is, those things then become compoundingly true.
Yeah, and look, I'm a man of colour who navigates a world where it's slightly different, slightly curiosity sometimes. So, I've faced lots of challenges where I have been marginalised, but then also times where I'm overly compensated too, right? Like, and that's one of the things I'm fascinated about, because oftentimes because my name's very Indian. And if I'm corresponding with people and they only hear my name, they've got a certain, maybe even a stereotype of who I am. And then when they talk to me, they hear my Kiwi accent, of course, and they might go, oh gosh, he's much more Kiwi than I was expecting because his name doesn't lend it. Or that I've got long hair as a man, that makes me slightly odd. So people go, oh gosh, I don't know about him. But then once you talk to me and find out I'm articulate and you know, intelligent, that then almost swings the, because the expectation has been lowered because of my name or my physical appearance. And then once you talk to me in person, I exceed the expectation. Sometimes people trust me even more.
Pendulum
so.
Pendulum has swung in the other direction.
It's like they overtrust me. And I find that really fascinating as a kind of that understanding of what happens when you're between that privilege and prejudice. And I think women often are in that situation too, right? Maybe there's an expectation on you and you need to be taken care of. I'm thinking more historical than maybe now, but you know, the idea that you might be less physically able, or women are going to be shorter than men. So when women tend to buck the stereotype or exceed that expectation, then you almost overcompensate by trusting more, right? You're expecting this person to be weak or disempowered, and then when they are very articulate and very warm or very obviously very capable, then you go, oh gosh, this person's, I'm going to trust them with everything, right? And that might be unfair too. So I think that's a really interesting dynamic between those kind of privileges and prejudices that go on in any stereotype or situation where you might be disempowered. Then there's that pendulum swing where if you can exceed the expectation, it often works in your favour even more so. And I notice that in my life quite a bit. But of course, when I was younger, it just felt like a burden. Gosh, I have to explain my name all the time, or where I was from, or try and come up with ways to connect, because often people might not necessarily look at me as valuable. But then once they was able to do something that surprised them, then I became more valuable. So it's interesting how that kind of works.
It's really interesting hearing you talk about this, and I think it's really valuable for people to think about. And I've heard you talk about this, the dynamic of between privileges and prejudices in the way that you see it before, but I think it's maybe not something that we think about enough. I think we get quite bogged down in prejudice and privilege and people only having one ever, that we lose in that a lot of nuance, and that's how we end up, I think, pigeonholing people into places. Like, I think that's probably where, I mean, not that that's the beginning and end of it, but a lot of the white savior complex comes from that, because you see that, well, we have all the privilege, you have all the prejudice, so, you know, you need some of this, and lose so much nuance from what it is that you're giving and receiving, and where all your different levels of human connection and well-being are. And so I think this is a really valuable thing for people to think about more. And in terms of feminism, what really frustrates me, or what's been frustrating me more recently, is when we buy into this rhetoric that all people who aren't men, so including women, transgender people, non-binary people, are all oppressed. They're all prejudiced in all ways, and that's what we're fighting against. And that really frustrates me, because that in itself is disempowering. It's like, well, no, a lot of us aren't. Obviously, I'm speaking for myself as a white woman, so I've got all this other, you know, all those other kind of privileges in other places. But even in general, there are some incredibly empowered people out there in multiple different ways. And as soon as we start to buy into those sorts of rhetorics, we disempower people who've actually got privileges and empower in these other areas, whether or not those are related to what people might associate privilege to be associated with.
And people do have, generally, most everybody has a place where they do feel powerful, right? So even if you leave your house and things are not great for you, or you're judged a lot or whatever, that, but at home you might be the person who organises everything. That's the person, the go-to, or maybe your community, right?
Where
you might be disempowered from your ethnicity in the wider world, but at home or in your community, you might be the spokesperson, right? Mm. So there's lots of those kind of things. And that's why I have a real struggle with kind of patriarchy as it's a word, right? Or matriarchy for that matter. Because on the one hand, of course, I certainly see it, right? I've been privileged for my gender, but I've also been disempowered for my gender. So, and patriarchy too, it's a system of, in some ways, oppression, but it's also a system of empowerment for other people. And some women got empowered hugely by the patriarchy, and some men got disempowered by the patriarchy. Generally, if you're an alpha female...
Yeah, again, class and race.
Yeah, played. You know, so it's really... And I guess that's a tricky thing, is figuring out what are the things to change. You change one thing and then it might change a whole lot of other things in ways that you don't necessarily want either. So it's very difficult to get to any kind of feeling of equality. So that's why I guess I like that idea of two, understanding that even in a particular space, you might have these privileges that go with it and also some prejudices, right? Mm. Like my wife's a midwife, and the vast majority of midwives are women. Mm. Very, very few midwives. You can count them on one hand. But if you went to obstetrics, right? So there are lots of men and women in that. And in fact, in the past, it's been mostly men who have been gynecologists and obstetrics. And now, you know, it's probably, 50-50, maybe even more women. But in midwifery, still vastly more women than men. So how has that happened, and why don't we see more men as midwives? But then midwives seem to feel much more personable and intimate, whereas your doctor feels very clinical, right? Mm. So women are tending to choose and want women as their midwives, but they don't mind if they're doctor is a main. So that's really an interesting dynamic. But there are other spaces where women have been less represented and are now much more, like law is a good example,
yeah.
Where it used to be a boys' club, but actually now there's many more women practicing law than men.
Yeah.
So, and still maybe the ratios and that partnership are still maybe weighted towards men, but that's likely to change as things go on.
We'll see.
But and some of that's got to do with what you might choose for your life too, because I've got a number of friends, women, because I used to work for a law firm, so I know a number of lawyers, and some of them, particularly women, who have been on that track of going towards partner, have looked at it and gone, well, actually, I don't necessarily want this. It's a lot of hours and time when actually my connections with my family and my community are much more important to me. Yeah. And so it is interesting to think how much of some of those gender equalities are about people's personal choices in their lives too, right? I work in Headstones, and the vast majority of the people that in my company are men, because there's a lot of physical labour. That doesn't mean women can't do it. I've got a very small guy who does a lot of physical activity and could easily be woman, but generally the whole idea of lifting stone lends itself to men. Yeah, and most of the trades are also men, but there are plenty of capable and able women too. But most of the nurses are women, right? So it's interesting to see how even in our more enlightened society we still have lots of kind of gender inequalities, and how much of that is about what people gravitate towards because they fulfill their particular needs, and what kind of things happen because society's engineered that particular way.
Yeah.
And what do we do to kind of look at that and empower people and encourage people to try different things?
I think the important thing for me on this particular topic is not that we have different amounts of gendered people doing different jobs. It's that they're all getting paid in ways that are equitable. I think it's not an issue that more of the midwives are women and more of the doctors are men, more of the nurses are women and more of the tradespeople are men, but how are they getting compensated for the work they're doing is, I think, the more interesting question for questions of equality and equity?
Oh, and that's a very big question. I mean, we have that discussion in our house all the time because, of course, if you're a doctor working in delivering babies, you're getting paid a lot more than a midwife who's delivering babies, right?
Yeah.
And the care may be actually less.
Yeah.
So that's really an interesting discussion.
Ooh.
There's a lot in there.
There's a lot in there.
I don't know. I don't have any answers. And I hope that some of my things aren't kind of very, what's the word, generational, right? Like I'm slightly older and I've had to work through this in my particular circumstance. It's not the same as anybody else's.
Yeah, I think they naturally are though, right? Like you can't get away from who you are, which is the point of this kōrero coming from you. Because I think that we can do as much work as we want to get away from like how old we are and what generation we were brought up in. But at the end of the day, that's a difficult thing to do. And it doesn't mean everything you say from that generation is bad. It's just that there are nuances that people from other generations would hear and be like, oh, that's interesting. I wouldn't have said it or thought about it that way because of that gap. I think it's inevitable.
Yeah.
My next question is, when do you feel most empowered to be authentically Ganesh?
I like being useful. I don't know where that comes from, but I feel most empowered when I can really make a situation better just from being there. And it may be dinner party and I can part of the entertainment, but also maybe facilitate really good conversation. It's as simple as that, right? Or it's being in a situation and going, I can help this be a much better outcome from being there. And that's, I guess, that's how I feel. And I try to, it's hard to be, but I try to be not precious, right? That if I'm not making a contribution, that I can be self-reflective enough to either change my input or remove myself from the situation, right? Mm. Or be okay with somebody saying, "It's you know, don't be here," right? Which is really tough, right? But I do feel the best when I am contributing to whatever's going on in really meaningful ways. And I feel the best about myself when other people recognise that, of course, where that's being valued and validated and you know, somebody's really excited. So even just being invited to things is really useful, right? Because you go, oh, gosh, they'd like me to be around. So I'm really conscious of that too, so I try and invite other people to be around me. So, yeah, that would be my answer to that question.
I love that. That's really beautiful. I believe that you've brought along a quote for us today. So for the four people in this section, we're asking them to bring a quote that empowers their lives. Then you can share it and then chat about why it's something that you like.
So the quote I've chosen, and it's anonymous, so I don't know who came up with it, but it's, in labours of love, every day is payday.
In labours of love, every day is payday.
And I feel like that's something I've tried to live by, and it's generally worked. If I'm enjoying what I'm doing because it feels really meaningful and purposeful and useful, then it's going to be great. I did hear somebody say that if what you do is creative and caring, then you really have the most fulfilled kind of a life. And I feel like the work I get to do, I wouldn't have I necessarily chosen it, but it does do those two things. It's creative. Making headstones is a creative process, and it's beautiful. And it's really meaningful to the people we do it for. So it feels very fulfilling. And I think you can do that if you can figure out ways to make you, whatever you're doing, creative and meaningful, then that does feel fulfilled. So if you're a nurse, it may be that you get to create things with your patients, create feelings of safety and love and care, and it does something really powerful and it feels fulfilling. And if you're an accountant and you can help people, you know, see a way through or understand what they're doing and feel empowered by it, and then that gives them a sense of safety and accomplishment, I think that's really good. So it can be done everywhere, I think, and it's just figuring out what. But if you don't have those things, if you don't feel like you're learning a little bit, that you're stretching a little bit, that you're making something of any importance, or that what you do is not valuable to anybody else, that they don't appreciate it or feel better for it, then that's always going to make you feel kind of less than, or you're never going to feel like it's enough, right?
Yeah. I get those two things in all three of my jobs, which makes me so happy.
Fabulous. Yeah. Fabulous. That's amazing.
I love that. In labours of love, every day is payday. Well, thank you for what you've shared thus far. We have some what you might call warm down questions. Okay, so as we draw to a close, what's one thing that you're going to take away from what you shared today?
I think that's the value of conversation, right? Just that we can discuss things and hopefully together come to some understandings that we didn't get before. That's the value of conversation. And everything's a conversation.
Mm.
And maybe conversation's the most basic form of negotiation. You know, it's they are coming together and the reciprocal validation of each other and the ability to see things from another point of view and be enlightened by it.
Mm.
That's the value of conversation. And everything's a conversation.
Mm.
And maybe conversation's the most basic form of negotiation. You know, it's they are coming together and the reciprocal validation of each other and the ability to see things from another point of view and be enlightened by it.
Mm.